and I'm so bothered by it that the cafe seems to spin. I lean across the table and whisper to Hector,
"Do you know who the person in the far corner is?"
He shakes his head.
"No, but I've noticed him watching us too. He was in here on Friday, sitting in the same seat and reading the same book."
There's something about him I don't like, but I don't know what it is.
"Don't worry, you have me here," he says.
"I really should leave," I say.
An odd desperation to get away has come over me. I try not to look at the man, but I do anyway. He's reading the book now,
the cover of which is angled toward me as though he wants me to see it.
It's brittle and worn, a dusty shade of gray.
"Pittacus of Mytilene and the Athenian War."
"Pittacus? Pittacus?" The man is watching me again, and though I can't see the bottom half of his face, his eyes suggest a knowing grin on his lips. All at once, I feel as though I've been struck by a train. Could this be my first Mogadorian? I jump up, smacking my knee against the bottom of the table and nearly knocking over Hector's wine bottle. My chair falls backwards, crashing to the ground. Everybody in the cafe turns.
"I gotta go, Hector," I say. "I gotta go."
I stumble through the doorway and make a mad dash for home, running faster than a speeding car, not caring if anyone sees. I'm back at Santa Teresa in seconds. I crash through the double doors and quickly slam them shut. I put my back against them and close my eyes. I try to slow my breathing, the twitching in my arms and legs, my quivering bottom lip. Sweat runs down the side of my face. I open my eyes. Adelina stands in front of me, and I fall headlong into her arms, not caring about the tension from an hour before. She tentatively hugs me back, probably confused by my sudden display of affection, which I haven't shown her in years. She pulls away, and I open my mouth to tell her what I've just seen, but she brings a finger to her lips, the same way I did to Ella at Mass. Then she turns and walks away. That night, after dinner and before prayers, I stand at the bedroom window gazing out as darkness falls, scanning the landscape for anything suspicious.
"Marina, what are you doing?"
I turn around. Ella stands behind me. I hadn't heard her approach. She moves through these halls like a shadow.
"There you are," I say, relieved. "Are you okay?"
She nods, but her big brown eyes tell me otherwise.
"What are you doing?"
she repeats.
"Just looking outside, that's all."
"What for? You're always looking out the windows at bedtime."
She's right. Every night since she arrived, since I saw the man watching me in the nave window, I've been looking outside at bedtime for any signs of him. I'm now certain he's the same man I saw in the cafe today.
"I'm looking for bad men, Ella. There are bad men out there sometimes."
"Really? What do they look like?"
"It's hard to say," I reply.
"I think they're very tall, and they're usually very dark and mean-looking. And some might even be muscular, like this," I add, doing my best bodybuilder pose. Ella giggles, going to the window. She stands on her tippy toes and pulls herself up to see out. It's been several hours since I was in the cafe, and I've managed to calm down a bit. I place my index finger on the foggy window and trace a figure onto it with two quick squeaks.
"That's the number 3,
Ella says.
"That's right, kiddo. I bet you can do better than that, huh?"
She smiles, sticks her finger onto the bottom of the window, and soon there is the beginning of a beautiful farmhouse and backyard barn. I watch as my number 3 is absorbed by Ella's perfect silo. 3 is the only reason I was allowed to leave that cafe today.
It's the distance from John Smith to myself. I'm now absolutely convinced that he is number four by the way he's being hunted. Just as I'm convinced the man at the cafe was a Mogadorian. This town is so small, I rarely see someone I don't recognize. And his book, Pittacus of Mytilene and the Athenian War, plus his constant stare, are no coincidence. The name Pittacus is one I've heard since childhood, since long before we made it to Santa Teresa. My number, 7. It's my only refuge now, my greatest defense. As unfair as it might be, I'm separated from death by the three others who all must die before me. So long as the charm holds, which, I assume, is why I was left alone and not attacked right at the cafe table. But one thing is certain. If he is a Mogadorian, they know where I am. And they could take me any time they choose and hold me until they kill 4 through 6. I wish I knew what's keeping them at bay and why I'm allowed to sleep in my bed again tonight. I know the charm ensures that we can't be killed out of order, but perhaps there's more to it than that. You and I, we're a team now, I say. Ella puts the finishing touches on her window drawing, curling her fingernails over the heads of a few cows to give them horns.
You want to be a team with me?
She asks in a tone of disbelief. You bet, I say. And hold out my pinky. Let's pinky swear on it. She smiles widely and hooks her pinky around mine. I shake it once. There, that settles it, I say. We turn back to the window and Ella wipes her picture away with the heel of her palm.
I don't like it here.
I don't like it here either, believe me. But don't worry, we'll both be out of here soon enough.
You think so? We'll leave together?
I turn and look at her. That wasn't what I had meant at all, but without thinking twice, I nod in agreement. I hope it isn't something I'll regret promising. If you're still here when I leave, then we'll leave together. Deal?
Deal! And I won't let them hurt you.
Who? I ask.
The bad men.
I smile. I would appreciate that very much. She leaves the window and walks to another, again pulling herself up to look out. As always, she moves like a ghost, making no sound. I still have no idea where she might have hidden today, but wherever it was clearly a place no one would think to look. And then an idea occurs to me.
Hey, Ella, I need your help.
I say. Ella drops from the window and looks at me expectantly.
I'm trying to find something here, but it's hidden. What is it?
She asks, leaning forward in excitement. It's a chest. It's wooden and looks very old, like you might expect to see on a pirate ship.
And it's here?
I nod. It's here somewhere, but I have no idea where. Somebody did a very good job of hiding it. You're just about the most clever girl I know. I bet you can find it in no time. She beams, rapidly nodding her head.
I'll find it for you, Marina. We're a team.
That's right, I agree. We are a team.
Chapter 13 Six drives our charcoal-colored SUV, which we saw for sale in a yard 2 miles down the road for $1,500, into town to buy groceries. While she's gone, Sam and I spar together in the backyard. The three of us have spent a week training, and I'm amazed at how good Sam's gotten in the short amount of time. Despite his small size, he's a natural. And what he lacks in strength, he makes up for in technique, which is much better than my own. At the end of each day, as Six and I retreat to the corners of the living room or to our empty rooms, Sam stays up studying fighting techniques on the internet. What Six learned from Katarina, and I learned from Henri, is a method of combat that loosely resembles a blend of jujitsu, taekwondo, karate, and bojuka here on Earth. A system designed to be committed to muscle memory, including grappling, blocks, fluid body movements, joint manipulation, and strikes to vital points of a person's central nervous system. For Six and me, having the benefit of telekinesis, it's a matter of sensing the subtlest of motions in a radius around us, and then reacting to them. Sam, however, needs to keep his enemies in front of him. While Six ends each session without a mark, Sam and I both finish with new scrapes and bruises. But despite them, Sam never loses passion or drive. Today is no different. He comes at me, chin tucked and eyes alert. He throws a right cross that I block, then a left side kick that I counter by sweeping his right leg out from under him, sending him crashing to the ground. He stands, then charges me again. Though he connects often, with my strength, his shots aren't very effective. But sometimes, I feign pain to boost his confidence. Six gets home an hour later. She changes into shorts and a t-shirt and joins us. We drill for a while, slowly doing the same block, counter kick over and over until it becomes second nature. But while I take it somewhat easy against Sam, Six goes all out against me, thrusting me backwards with such force that the wind is knocked out of me. Sometimes I get irritated, but I can still tell I'm getting better. She's no longer able to deflect my telekinesis with a casual flick of the wrist. Now she's required to throw her whole body into it. Sam takes a break and watches from the side with Bernie Kosar.
"You are better than that, Johnny. Show me the good stuff already," she says after she upends me when I threw a sloppy roundhouse kick.
I charge her, closing the gap between us in a tenth of a second. I throw a left hook, but Six blocks it, taking hold of my bicep and using my momentum to toss me over her head. I brace myself for a painful landing, but she doesn't let go of my arm, instead twisting me back over her shoulder so my feet hit the ground. She wraps her arms around my arms. My back is smashed against her chest. She sticks her face against mine and playfully kisses me on the cheek. Before I can react, she kicks the back of my knees and my butt hits the grass. My arms are swept out from under me, and I'm flat on my back. Six easily pins me, and she's so close I can count the hairs on her brow. Butterflies flood my stomach.
"Okay," Sam finally interrupts. "I think you got him pretty good. You can let him up now."
Six's smile widens, and mine does too. We stay that way for a second longer before she leans back and hefts me up by my shoulders.
"My turn with Six," Sam says.
I take a deep breath, then shake my arms to rid them of their jitters. "She's all yours," I say, making a beeline towards the house.
"John?"
Six says just as I reach the back door. I turn, trying to tamp down a strange, fluttery sensation at the sight of her.
"Yeah?"
"We've been in this house for a week now. I think it's time to lose whatever sentimentality or fear you've been holding on to."
For a second, after what just happened, I think she's talking about Sarah.
"The chest?"
she says. "I know," I say, and I enter the house, sliding the door behind me. I go to my room and pace, taking deep breaths, trying to figure out what just happened out in the yard. I go to the bathroom and splash cold water on my face. I stare into the mirror. Sarah would kill me if she caught me looking at Six like that. I tell myself again that I have nothing to worry about because Lorians love one person for life. If Sarah is my one love, then Six is
simply a crush. Back in my room, I lie on my back, fold my hands across my stomach, and close my eyes. I take deep breaths, holding each one in for a five count before exhaling out my nose. 30 minutes later, I open the door and creep down the hall, hearing Sam and Six milling about in the living room. The only place I could find to hide my chest in the house was in the utility closet, on top of the hot water heater. I struggle getting it out, making as little noise as possible. Then I tiptoe back to my room, gently closing and locking the door behind me. Six is right. It's time. No more waiting. I grab hold of the lock. It quickly warms, then squirms against the palm of my hand, taking on an almost liquid form, and snaps open. The inside glows brightly. It's never done that before. I reach in and remove the coffee can containing Henri's ashes and his letter, still in its sealed envelope. I close the lid and relock it. I know it's stupid, but I feel like I'm somehow keeping Henri alive by not reading the letter he left behind. Once the chest is open, and once the letter is read, he'll have nothing left to tell me, nothing left to teach. And then he'll become nothing more than a memory. I'm not ready for it yet. I open the closet where my clothes sit in a pile, and I bury the coffee can and letter under them. Then I grab the chest and leave the room, hovering in the hallway to listen to Sam and Six streaming a show online called Ancient Aliens. Sam is asking Six about all the alien theories he knows, and Six quickly confirms or denies them based on the teachings of Katarina. Sam furiously scribbles answers on his legal pad, which then breeds more questions that Six patiently answers or shrugs her shoulders at. Sam eats it up, drawing parallels to what he already knows. The pyramids of Giza, they were built by the Lorik?
Partly us, but mostly the Mogadorians.
What about the Great Wall of China?
Humans.
Roswell, New Mexico?
You know, I've asked Katarina that once, and she had no idea. So I don't know either.
Wait. How long have the Mogadorians been coming here?
Almost as long as we have, she says.
So, like, this war between you two? Is it new?
Not necessarily. What I know is that both sides have traveled to Earth for thousands of years. Sometimes we were here at the same time. And from what I understand, much of it was spent on friendly terms. But then something happened that ruined the relationship, and the Mogadorians left for a very long time. Beyond that, I don't know much. And I have no idea when they started coming back.
I cross the living room and plop the chest in the middle of the dining room floor. Sam and Six glance up. Six grins, again giving me strange flutters. I smile back, but it feels insincere. I figure we might as well open this thing together.
Sam begins rubbing his hands with a crazy look in his eyes.
Geez, Sam, I say. You look like you're about to murder somebody.
Oh, come on, he says. You've been teasing me with this chest for almost a month now, and I've been patient and I've kept my mouth shut out of respect for Henri and everything, but how often do I get to see the treasures from an alien planet? I just think about how the guys at NASA would die to be sitting where I am right now. You can't blame me for being so into this.
Would you be mad if this whole time it's been full of nothing but dirty laundry?
Alien dirty laundry? Sam asks sarcastically.
I laugh, then reach down and grab hold of the lock. My hand instantly glows when touching the cold metal, and the lock again warms, shaking and twisting in my grip, protesting the ancient powers that keep it closed. When it clicks open, I remove the lock, set it aside,
and place my hand on the chest's top. Six and Sam both lean forward in anticipation. I lift the lid. The chest is yet again ablaze with light that hurts my eyes. The first thing I do is remove the velvet bag holding the seven orbs that make up Lorien's solar system. I think of Henri and how he watched the light glow and pulsate at Lorien's core, showing that the planet is still alive, albeit hibernating. I place the bag in Sam's hand. All three of us peer down into the chest. Something else is lit up.
What is that glowing? Six asks.
No idea. It never did that before. She reaches down and plucks a rock from the bottom of the chest. It's a perfectly round crystal, no bigger than a ping-pong ball. And when she touches it, the light brightens even more. And then it fades and begins to slowly pulse. We watch the crystal, transfixed by the glow. Then suddenly, Six lets it drop to the floor. The crystal ceases to pulse and resumes its steady glow. Sam reaches down to pick it up.
Don't!
Six yells. He looks up confused.
Something doesn't feel right about it, she says.
What do you mean? I ask.
It felt like pinpricks against my palm. When I grabbed hold of it, I got a really bad feeling.
This stuff is my inheritance, I say. Maybe I'm the only one allowed to touch it. I bend down and carefully pick up the glowing crystal. Within seconds, it feels as if I'm holding a radioactive cactus. My stomach compresses and acid climbs up my throat. Then I instantly toss the crystal onto a blanket. I swallow. Maybe I'm doing it wrong.
Maybe we don't know how to use it. I mean, you said Henri kept you from seeing inside because you weren't ready. Maybe you're still not ready.
Well, that would be pretty lame, I say.
This sucks, Sam says.
Six walks into the kitchen and returns with two towels and a plastic bag. She carefully grabs the glowing crystal with a towel and drops both into the bag, which she then wraps in a second towel. You really think that's necessary? I ask. My stomach continues to gurgle. She shrugs.
I don't know about you, but the feeling I got when I touched it was bad news. Better safe than sorry.
What's left in the chest is everything comprising my inheritance, and I'm not really sure where to start. I reach in and grab an object I've seen before, the oblong crystal Henri used to spread the lumen from my hands to the rest of my body. It comes alive and bathes the dining room in its bright light. The crystal center begins swirling with what looks like smoke, twisting and turning back on itself, as I have seen it do before.
Now we're talking, Sam says.
Here, I say, giving it to him. The crystal falls inert when it transfers hands. I've already seen it. Also, inside the chest are a few smaller crystals, a black diamond, a collection of brittle leaves bound with twine, and a star-shaped talisman the same pale blue as the pendant around my neck, which tells me it's Lorelite, the rarest gem found only at Lorien's core. There's also a bright red oval bracelet and an amber-colored stone in the shape of a raindrop.
What do you think that is?
Sam asks, pointing to a flat, circular stone the same milky white color as a pearl that's stuck in the corner. Don't know, I say.
How about that?
He asks, this time pointing to a small dagger that looks to have a blade made of diamond. I lift it from the chest. The handle fits snug in my hand, as though it was made for it. And I suppose it was. The blade isn't more than 4 inches long, and just by seeing the way the light glints along its edge, I can tell it's far sharper than any razor one might find on Earth.
What about that thing?
Sam asks again, pointing to something else, and I have no doubt he'll ask the same question over and over until he's inquired about every object inside. Here, I say, setting the dagger down and removing the 7 orbs in an effort to keep him occupied. Check this out. I blow on them, and tiny lights flicker across their surfaces. Then I toss them up in the air, and they instantly spring to life, spinning in orbit around the orange-sized sun in the center. It's Lorien's solar system, I say. 6 planets, 1 sun, and this one here, I add, pointing to the 4th orb, which remains the same various shades of ashen gray as the last time I'd seen it, is Lorien, as it looks today, at this very moment. The glow at its center is what's left.
Wow, Sam says. NASA dudes would be crapping themselves right now looking at this.
And watch this, I say. Illuminating my right hand, I sweep the light over the orb, and all at once, the surface changes from its depressing gray tones to vibrant blues and greens of the forests and oceans. This is the planet as it was the day before the attack.
Wow,
Sam says again, staring in awe with his mouth hanging open. And while the rotating planets have him transfixed, I look back in the chest. Do you know what any of this is? Or what it does? I ask Six, who doesn't respond. I turn and see she's just as amazed as Sam by the solar system spinning 2 feet above the floor. Since Henri had told me they weren't part of my legacy, which means they weren't locked in the chest, I had wrongly assumed she'd seen them before. But it makes sense she hasn't. They can only be activated after the first legacy develops. Six, I say again. She comes back to reality, turns to me, and I find myself looking away once we make eye contact. Do you know what any of this stuff is?
Not really, she murmurs,
running her hands over the stone's surfaces.
This is the healing stone Henri and I used at the school,
she says, pointing out a flat, black rock I've seen before. Then she freezes, a faint gasp escaping her lips. Sam and I exchange confused expressions. She lifts a pale yellow stone, its surface waxy and smooth, from the chest, and holds it up to the light.
Oh my God,
she marvels, flipping it over.
Tell me,
I prod. She looks me right in the eyes.
Zitharis, she says. It comes from our first moon.
She brings the small stone to her forehead, squeezing her eyes shut. The faint yellow shade of the stone darkens slightly. She opens her eyes and hands the stone to me. I frown and take it from her, my fingertips grazing the palm of her hand. Sam inhales sharply.
What the?
He looks terrified, groping for me like he's blind.
What's going on?
I ask, slapping Sam's hands away from my face.
You're invisible,
Six says quietly. I look down at my lap, and it's true. I've completely vanished. I drop the Zitharis on the floor like a hot potato and instantly become visible.
The Zitharis, Six explains, allows one guard to transfer a legacy to another, but only for a short period of time. An hour, I think, maybe 2. I can't say for sure. All you have to do is charge it by focusing your energy on the stone. Put it to your forehead, and bam, it's ready to go.
Charge it? Like a battery? Sam asks.
Exactly. And it won't start using the legacy until it's touched again.
I look at the stone.
Sweet.
Looks like somebody other than you is taking a trip into town.
And somebody other than you is going to be resistant to fire, she says playfully.
If you're nice to me, then it's definitely a possibility, I say.
Sam picks the stone up and clenches his entire body in deep concentration. Nothing happens.
Oh, come on, he says to the stone. I promise to use it for the power of good. No girls' locker rooms, I swear.
Sorry, Sam, Six says. I'm pretty sure this stuff only works on us.
He sets the Zitharis down, and we dig through the rest of the chest to see if anything else is activated by touch. But after an hour of studying and holding all 17 artifacts, blowing hot air on them, squeezing them tightly, nothing else engages. Aside from the glowing crystal wrapped in the towel, the larger oblong crystal with the smoky center, and the solar system still rotating above us. The healing stone, however, does cure the cuts and bruises Six has been stamping my body with.
Man, I've waited most of my life to open this thing, and now that I have, a lot of it seems useless to me, I say.
I'm sure their uses will reveal themselves in time, Six assures me. Things like this need to be slept on. It's usually when they've left your mind completely that answers finally come.
I nod, looking back at everything lying around the chest. Six is right. Forcing an answer only guarantees that no answer will come. Yeah, maybe some of it only activates with further legacies. Who knows? I say with a shrug. I put everything back inside, feeling compelled to keep the glowing crystal covered with the towel. I leave the solar system out, which continues its circular march. I close and lock the chest and carry it down the hall.
Don't be discouraged, John, Six says behind me. As Henri said, you're probably not ready to see it all yet.
Chapter 14. I can't sleep. Partly because of the chest. For all I know, one of the gems inside could give me power to morph into different creatures like Bernie Kosar. Or one could create an iron barrier around me, impossible to penetrate by enemy attack. But how'll I know without Henri? I feel sad. Defeated. But mostly, I can't stop thinking about Six. Can't stop picturing her face hovering inches above mine, or the sugary scent of her breath, or the way the setting sun had made her eyes glow. In that moment, I had an irrepressible desire to stop training and to simply wrap my arms around her and squeeze her down onto me. A pang of longing to do that even now, hours later, has anchored itself in my heart, and that's what's really keeping me up. That and the overwhelming guilt I feel about my attraction to her. The person I'm supposed to be longing for is Sarah. There's too much on my mind to expect sleep. Too many emotions. Pain, desire, confusion, guilt. I lie another 20 minutes before giving up on sleep. I whip aside my blanket and pull on a pair of pants and a gray tee. Bernie Kosar follows me from the room and down the hallway. I poke my head into the living room to see if Sam's asleep. He is, wrapped up in a blanket on the floor like a worm in a cocoon, and I turn and walk back. Six's room is directly across the hall from mine, and her door's ajar. I stand looking at it, and I hear Six rustle on the floor.
John?
She whispers. I cringe, and my heart immediately races. Yeah? I reply, still standing outside.
What are you doing?
Nothing, I whisper. I can't sleep.
Come in,
she says. I push open the door. Her room is pitch black, and I can't see anything.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, everything's fine, I say. I barely turn on my lumen, and the faint glow is like a nightlight. I keep my eyes off her and on the carpet. Just too much on my mind, you know. I was maybe thinking of going for a walk or a run or something.
Well, that's kind of dangerous, don't you think? Don't forget, you're on the FBI's 10 most wanted list with a fat reward on your head, she says.
I know, but it's still dark out and you could make us invisible, couldn't you? I mean, that's if you wanted to come along.
I increase the lights on my hands and I can see Six sitting on the floor with a couple of blankets over her legs and her hair's pulled back with loose strands falling around her face. She shrugs, then tosses the blankets aside and stands. She's wearing black yoga pants and a white tank. I can't stop myself from staring at her bare shoulders. I look away when I'm hit with the absurd suspicion that she can feel my eyes on her.
Sure,
she says, pulling the band from her hair and rewrapping her ponytail. I always have a hard time sleeping, especially on the floor.
I hear that, I say.
Do you think we'll wake up Sam, though? I shake my head. She responds with a shoulder shrug and lifts her hand. I take it immediately. Six disappears, but my hand still glows, and I can see her foot imprints in the carpet. Then I extinguish my hand, and we tiptoe from the room and down the hallway. Bernie Kosar follows, and when we reach the living room, Sam lifts his head from the floor and stares right at us. Six and I stop, and I hold my breath to remain silent. I think about Sam's obvious crush on Six, and how he'd be devastated if he saw us holding hands.
Hey, Bernie, he says groggily, then drops his head and rolls over with his back facing us.
We remain silent for a few seconds, and then Six leads us across the living room and into the kitchen to leave through the back door. The night is warm and filled with the sounds of crickets and swaying palm fronds. I inhale deeply as Six and I walk hand in hand. I find it odd that Six's hand seems so small and delicate in mine, despite her amazing physical strength. I love the way it feels. Bernie Kosar races through the heavy brush lining the gravel drive, while Six and I stroll silently down its center. It dead ends into a narrow road, and we turn left.
I can't stop thinking about what you went through, I finally say. But what I would rather tell her is that I can't stop thinking about her. Being held prisoner for half a year, having to witness Katerina being, well, you know what I mean.
Sometimes I forget it happened. And other times, it's all I can think about for days, she replies.
Yeah, I say, drawing out the word.
I don't know. I guess it goes without saying that I miss Henri, and it kills me that he's gone. But after hearing your story, I realize how lucky I really am. I mean, I got to say goodbye to him and everything. Plus, he was there while I went through my first legacies. I can't imagine going through that alone like you did.
It was really, really hard, that's for sure. I could have used her the day I started to gain my invisibility legacy. I could have used her even more for girl talks when I was growing up. They were pretty much our parents on Earth, right?
Right, I say.
What I find funny is that now that Henri's gone, the things I remember most about him are the things I usually hated. Like when we would leave someplace behind and we'd drive for hours and hours and hours down the highway headed someplace I'd never even heard of, when all I wanted to do was just get out of the car. Now the conversations we had on those trips are the ones I remember most. Or when we started training in Ohio, and he made me do the same thing over and over and over again. I hated it so much, you know? But now I can't look back on any of it without smiling. Like one time after my telekinesis finally came, we were training in the snow, and he was throwing all these objects so I could learn to deflect them. I had to redirect them back at the source, and he heaved a meat tenderizer really hard at me, and I used its own velocity to whip it back at him, and at the very last second,
He had to jump headfirst into the snow to keep from being hit, I say, smiling to myself. The pile of snow was actually a snow-covered rose bush with all these thorns. You would not believe the noise he made. Stuff like that, I won't ever forget. A car approaches on the side of the road, and we scoot off into the ditch until it passes. It whips into a stone driveway of a nearby house, and a man in a black leather jacket jumps out. He pounds on the front door, yelling for whoever is inside to open up. "Jesus, what time is it?" I ask Six. Six moves towards the man in the house, my hand still in hers.
"Does it matter?"
As we creep within 10 feet of him, the smell of alcohol hits me. He stops pounding his fist against the door to yell,
"You better goddamn open this door, Charlene, or you don't want to know what I'm gonna do."
Six sees the revolver in his waistband the same time I do, and she squeezes my hand.
"Screw this guy," Six whispers.
He pounds again and again until the lights in the front window turn on. Then, through the door, a woman shouts,
"Get out of here! Just get out of here, Tim!"
"Open the door right now," he yells back. "Or else, Charlene! Or else, you hear me?"
We're within touching distance of him. I can see the faded tattoo below his left ear as a bald eagle holding a snake in its talons. She yells back, her voice shakier than before.
"Just leave me alone, Tim! Why are you here? Why won't you just leave me alone?"
He pounds and yells even harder. I'm about to put him in a chokehold, squeeze that bald eagle and snake right off his neck, when I see the gun slowly crawl up his lower back until it floats away from him in Six's invisible hand. She puts the barrel of the gun up against the back of the man's head and buries it in his brown hair. She cocks the hammer with a loud click. The man stops pounding on the door. He stops breathing, too. Six pushes the gun even harder into his skull, and then she pushes it stiffly to the right, spinning the man around. The sight of the floating gun in front of his face makes him go white. He blinks and shakes his head violently, expecting to wake up in his bed or in the back alley of whatever bar he came from. Six moves the gun side to side, and I wait for her to say something, to really spook the hell out of him. But instead, she suddenly turns the gun towards his car. She shoots, and a radius of broken glass appears on the windshield. He screams shrilly and bursts into tears. Six aims the gun at his face again, and he quiets down, letting a stream of snot hit his upper lip.
"Please, please, please," he says. "I'm sorry. God, I'm gonna leave right now. I swear I'm leaving."
Six cocks the hammer again. I see the curtain of the front window move to the right and expose the face of a large blonde woman. I squeeze Six's hand and she squeezes back.
"I'm leaving right now. I'm leaving. I'm leaving."
The man sputters to the gun. Six aims at his car again and empties the chamber with a loud bang. The rear driver's side window explodes into 1,000 pieces.
"No! Okay! Okay!"
the man shouts. There's suddenly a wet spot on the inner thigh of his jeans. Six motions the gun at the front window, and he makes eye contact with a blonde woman inside.
"And I'll never come back. I'll never, ever, ever come back."
The gun bobs to the left twice, indicating he can leave. The man rips his car door open and dives in. Stones spit out from under his tires as he reverses out of the driveway and then barrels down the road. The woman in the window continues to stare at the handgun that's floating next to her front door. And that's when Six flings it over the house with such force that it's sure to land in the next county. We run back to the road, and then we continue to run until there isn't a house in sight. I wish I could see Six's face.
I could do that kind of stuff all day, she finally says. It's like being a superhero.
Humans do love their superheroes, I say.
Do you think she'll call the police? Nah, she's probably going to think it was all a bad dream.
Or the best dream she's ever had, I say. Our talk turns to all the good things we could do for Earth with our legacies, if we weren't busy being hunted or hated. How did you train yourself anyway? I ask. I can't imagine learning the things I did if it hadn't been for Henri pushing me so much.
What other choice did I have? Either we adapt or we perish. So I adapted. Katerina and I trained for years before we were captured, but obviously never once after my legacies developed. When I finally got out of that cave, I promised myself that her death wasn't going to be in vain, and the only way to do that was to seek revenge. So I picked up where we had left off. It was hard at first, especially on my own, but little by little I began to learn and grow stronger. Besides, I've had more time than you. My legacies came sooner than yours, and I'm older than you.
You know, I say, my 16th birthday, or at least the day I celebrated as my birthday with Henri, was 2 days ago.
John, why didn't you tell us?
She asks, then lets go of my hand and playfully shoves me away, making me instantly visible.
We could have celebrated.
I smile and reach for her, feeling blindly in the dark. She takes my hand and interlocks her fingers in mine, allowing my thumb to rest over hers. The thought of Sarah comes into my head, and I find myself instantly pushing it out. So, what was she like? I ask. Katerina. A moment of silence passes.
Compassionate. She was always helping others. And she was funny. We used to joke and laugh a lot, which probably seems hard to believe seeing how serious I usually am.
I chuckle. I didn't say it, you did.
But hey, no changing the subject. Why didn't you say anything about your birthday?
I don't know. I actually forgot about it until yesterday. And then it just seemed pointless with everything else going on.
It's your birthday, John. It's not pointless. Every birthday any of us are lucky to have is cause for celebration, considering what's hunting us. And anyway, had I known, I might have even taken it easy on you in training.
Yeah, you must feel terrible beating up a guy like that on his birthday, I say, and then nudge her. She nudges me back. Bernie Kosar leaps from the brambles and trots beside us. Several burrs are stuck to his fur like Velcro, and I let go of Six's hand to pluck them all off. We reach the end of the road. Tall grass and a winding river lie ahead of us. We turn around and amble back towards the house. Does it bother you that you never got your chest? I ask after a few minutes of silence.
In a way, I think it fueled me that much more. It was gone. There was nothing I could do about it. So I did what I thought was smart and chose to focus on finding the rest of you. I just wish I could have found number three before they did.
Well, you found me. I can't imagine I would have survived this long if you hadn't. Or Bernie Kosar, for that matter. Or even Sarah. As soon as I say Sarah's name, Six's grip loosens a little. Guilt rises in my chest as we make our way back to the house. I do love Sarah. But it's hard to imagine a life with her when I'm so far away, on the run,
with no sense of where the future will take me. The only life I can imagine right now is the one I'm living. The one with Six. We reach the house, and I find myself wishing our walk wasn't over. I try to stall, slowing my steps, hovering at the end of the driveway. You know, I only know you as Six, I say. Did you have a name at one time? Of course I did. But I didn't use it very often. I didn't go to school like you. Well, I did for a little while, but then we decided I was better off staying home. So, what was your name?
Marin Elizabeth.
Whoa, really? Why do you sound so surprised? I don't know. Marin Elizabeth seems kind of dainty and feminine. I think I expected you to have something strong and mythic, like Athena, or maybe Xena. You know, like the warrior princess? Or even Storm. Storm would have suited you perfectly. Six laughs, and the sound of it makes me want to pull her to me. Of course I don't, but I want to. And maybe that's what's most telling.
I'll have you know, I used to be a little girl who once wore ribbons in her hair.
Yeah? What color?
Pink.
I think I'd pay money to see that.
Forget it, you don't have enough.
I'll have you know, I say, mimicking the same playful voice she just used. I have a whole chest of rare gems at my disposal. Just point me in the direction of a pawn shop. She laughs, then says,
I'll keep my eyes open for one.
We continue to stand at the mouth of our driveway, and I look up at the stars and the moon, which is three quarters full. I listen to the wind and to Six's feet on the gravel as she shifts her weight from one leg to the other. I take a deep breath. I'm really glad we went for that walk, I say.
So am I.
I look where she's standing, wishing she were visible, so I could read her expression. Could you imagine if every night were like this, living your life without having to worry about what or who might be lurking out of sight? Without always having to peer over your shoulder to see if you're being followed. Wouldn't it be amazing to be able to forget, just once, what's peeking over the horizon?
Of course it'd be nice, she says.
And it will be nice when we finally have that luxury. I hate what we have to do. I hate the situation we're in. I wish it were different. I look for Lorien in the sky and release her hand. She makes herself visible. I grab her by the shoulders and turn her towards me. Six inhales deeply. Just as I duck my head towards hers, an explosion rocks the back of the house. Six and I scream and tumble to the ground. A plume of fire lifts up over the roof, and flames instantly spread inside. Sam! I yell. From 50 feet away, I rip the front windows out. They shatter against the concrete walkway. Smoke comes billowing out. Before I know it, I've burst into a dead sprint. I take a deep breath and leap, crashing into the house and splintering the door from its hinges.
Chapter 15. Each night lately, I lie awake for hours. My eyes open. Ears attuned to the sounds of silence around me. Every so often, I lift my head when I hear a distant noise, a drop of water hitting the floor, a person shifting in her sleep, and sometimes I crawl from bed and go to the window to be assured there's nothing out there, an obvious attempt to feel some semblance of security, however flimsy it might be. Each night passes with less sleep than the night before. I've grown weak, exhausted to the point of delirium. I have trouble eating. I know worrying doesn't do me any good, but no amount of willing myself to rest or eat does anything to change how I feel. And when I finally do sleep, nothing keeps away the terrible dreams that wake me up again. There's been no sign of the mustached man in the week since I saw him in the cafe,
but I can't dismiss the notion that just because I haven't seen him doesn't mean he isn't out there. I keep returning to the same questions. Who was in my cave? Who or what was the mustached man in the cafe? Why was he reading a book with the name Pittacus on the cover? And most importantly, why did he let me go if he's Mogadorian? None of it makes sense. Not even the title of his book. I've turned up nothing other than a brief summary of the plot online. A Greek general, given to short pithy statements, defeats an Athenian army when they were on the verge of attacking the city of Mytilene. What does it have to do with anything? The questions of the cave and book aside, I've come to two conclusions. The first is that nothing was done to me because of my number. For the time being, it's keeping me safe. But for how long? The second is that the crowd of people in the cafe kept the Mogadorian from making a move. But from what I know of them, a Mogadorian wouldn't let a few witnesses deter him. I've stopped rushing to and from school ahead of the others and have instead attached myself to their large group. To keep Ella safe, I've stopped walking with her in public. I know it hurts her feelings, but it's for the best. She doesn't deserve to be mixed up in my problems. But there's one thing that has given me a shade of hope in all this. A noticeable change has occurred in Adelina. Worry creases her forehead. There's a nervous twitch to her eyes when she thinks nobody's watching, and they dart from one section of a room to another, like a scared, threatened animal. The same way they used to years ago, when she still believed. And while we haven't spoken since I fell into her arms after rushing from the cafe, it's these changes in her that have me thinking I might have my Saipan back. Darkness. Silence. 15 sleeping bodies. I lift my head and glance across the room. Instead of seeing a small lump in Ella's bed, the covers are thrown aside, and her bed is empty. It's the third night in a row I've noticed her missing, and yet I never hear her leave. But I have bigger things to worry about than where she's gone off to. I drop my head on the pillow and glance out the window. A full moon, bright and yellow, hangs just outside. I stare at it for a long time, entranced by the way it hovers there. I take a deep breath and close my eyes. When I reopen them, the moon has turned from bright yellow to blood red, and it seems to shimmer, but then I realize it's not the moon I'm staring at, but rather its reflection, shining brightly in the dark waters of some great pool. Steam rises off its surface, and the air reeks of pungent iron. I lift my head again, and only then do I see him standing amid a ravaged, bloodied battlefield. Bodies are strewn everywhere, the dead and dying, the aftermath of some war in which there are no survivors. I instinctively bring my hands to my body, feeling for puncture wounds or cuts, but I'm unscathed. That's when I see her, the girl with the gray eyes I've dreamed about, the one I painted on the cave's wall beside John Smith. She lies motionless at the base of the shore. I rush to her. Blood gushes from her side and soaks into the sand and is carried out to sea. Her raven hair clings to her ashen face. She's not breathing, and I'm completely and utterly anguished to know there's not a single thing I can do about it. And then behind me comes a deep, mocking laugh. My eyes close before I slowly turn around to face my enemy. My eyes open, and the battlefield disappears. The familiar bed in the darkened room has returned. The moon is normal and bright yellow. I get up and walk to the window. I scan the dark terrain, still and quiet. No sign of the mustached man, or anything else for that matter. All the snow has melted, and the moon glistens on the wet cobblestones. Is he watching me? I turn away and crawl back into bed. I lie on my back, taking deep breaths to calm myself. My whole body is tense and rigid. I think about the cave and how I haven't been back since the boot prints appeared.
I roll to my side with my back towards the window. I don't want to see what's out there. Ella still isn't in her bed. I try to wait up for her to return, but I fall asleep.